Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Boo. That's right, boo. Boo. Welcome back to the House of Pod. My name is Kaveh Hoda. I think I'm pronouncing that correctly. Today, we're going to be doing our annual Halloween episode here on what I should call it, the Haunted House of Pod, because this is going to be a spooky episode.
It's going to be like a minor key version of like, and I'm alive and I'm sick.
Yeah. You're the musician, so I will count you on you to do that. And let me introduce you while I'm at it. Mark Gasway, musician, friend, welcome back to the show.
I'm going to be completely, utterly mortified at myself when I listen to that. Go on, let's go.
I'm not cutting that. Also joining us, Dr. Steven Sample, it's been so long since you've been here, buddy.
What up? I know. You've been avoiding me. It's good to be back.
I think I've invited you multiple times, and I think you have been the problem here.
Because I'm working all the freaking time.
That's probably true. You are a hardworking ER doctor. Where again?
I work in Jasper, Indiana, in the armpit of the United States.
Yeah, you remember how much trouble Steve Martin got in when he called Terre Haute the armpit of the United States?
He did, and I'm only about 45 minutes from Terre Haute, where I work. So,
where I was born, by the way, Mark. Did you know that?
Mm-hmm. I know that.
I'm a Hoosier. Also joining us, how exciting this is, Dr. Tyler Black, psychiatrist, suicide specialist. How are you, sir?
I am doing very well. Thank you for having me again.
Can I call you Tyler?
Of course.
I'm so glad you're here. I'm glad you're all here. Today, the theme is going to be horror films, which we've talked about, but we're going to talk about horror films that have a heavy psychiatric theme or are set in a psychiatric ward. Now, this is a very common theme in movies. Not just horror films, but themes in movies in general. I actually looked at a Wikipedia page, someone, when I put this on Twitter requesting films, lots of advice, lots of ideas for movies came in, and someone put a link to a Wikipedia page just based on hospital ward-based movies, and there was like well over 200. Let me just start with the very basics. Tyler, why do you think it's so... Why do you think that's something that Hollywood has grasped on so much? What is it about psychiatric wards that interest people so much?
I think it sort of ties back to sort of early views of mental illness that were seen sort of like possessions or like spiritual conflicts or those types of things. So there's always been like a haunting element to asylums and those types of things. Of course, even in the 1800s or 1900s, people working in the asylums didn't feel like they were working with haunted people. But of course, I can, you know, as you can imagine, like the common view of it was the, you know, this is a dangerous place to be. I think it also because psychiatric wards often are locked and confined, and that's a really great way to create tension in a movie is to make people in a confined space. And unfortunately, I think the tropes of psychiatric staff being sort of like evil and coercive is like another thing. You have to have like a mastermind, and you have, so you have these confined people there. So, you know, some of it is tropes, some of it is, you know, some of it is sort of the stigma of mental illness. And then some of it is just, you know, how the public has for, you know, millennia seen mental illness, which is, you know, a spiritual conflict or conflict of good and evil within a person or those types of things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Have you ever seen a movie where you're like, that's actually a pretty accurate depiction of a psychiatric ward?
One of them we're going to talk about that I thought did it really well was Smile. So it's one of our movies. So I thought they did it quite well. Not because, I mean, the story isn't realistic in terms of what happens, but in the way that people around them, around the person who was struggling, treated them. Like they were all being relatively pretty reasonable with her. They're trying their hardest to understand from her point of view, but didn't. So I think that one does it well. I think it's so much easier for me to, it's so hard to watch a movie with a psych ward in it and not just pick it apart to death.
Just
so
I imagine
it's really hard to say. I'll say Good Will Hunting is my favorite portrayal of a psychiatrist. Like I think that's a really good one.
Was he a psychiatrist or was he a therapist?
Therapist.
Because this is a recurrent issue I have with these movies. They really use doctor loosely.
Yeah.
And it's never clear to me if it's a psychiatrist or a therapist, if it's a medical doctor or some other form of therapist. Okay. So you mentioned Smile. We're also going to be talking about Shutter Island and a movie called The Ward. Now, let me just ask you guys, Mark, Steven, where do psychological horror films, where do these sorts of horror films rank in your pantheon of horror films? And actually, I'm sorry, before you answer that, let me also state to our listeners, there are going to be massive spoilers in this episode. So if you haven't watched, if you haven't watched Shutter Island by now, I'm sorry. It came out in 2010. I don't feel that bad about it. It's going to get spoiled. If you haven't watched Smile, that's one. Maybe it's kind of recent that you may want to watch before you watch this. If you haven't watched The Ward for this episode, I can't say for you to do it. We'll get to that.
Nor can I.
We'll get to that. Just
trying to complete your John Carpenter collection.
Yeah. Yeah, if you have to complete your John Carpenter viewing, there will be spoilers. But anyways, so sorry, getting back to the question I have for you two, where do these types of horror films rank in your pantheon of horror films? And I should also mention, Mark is a horror blog writer. He has a blog about horror films. It's very entertaining. We're going to plug that for sure before we leave the show. So let me ask you guys, where these rank for you?
I'll go. So The Ward, I thought, I watched that today for the first time. I felt kitschy and campy, and it reminded me of like kind of a formulaic 80s type horror movie. Though I will admit that I was I was not expecting the twist. I think I was half paying attention. And when the twist came, I went, oh, that's okay. Should I spoil it?
Wait for that.
Yeah, I'll wait. So there's a twist that I was not catching. And then it became a little better to me in retrospect, just because I was trying to think about it. And kind of the same goes for Shutter Island, because this was my second viewing. And so I had some inside knowledge on it. And so in retrospect, it was actually way better the second time that I watched it, even knowing it, because the first time I think I missed a lot. You're allowed to not pay attention the first time, but when you know what's happening the second time. But, you know, I'm a Gen X kid. I grew up in the 80s and 90s. So for me, my horror movies will always be the Friday the 13th series, the Nightmare on Elm Street series, especially the first few or the first 12, Friday the 13th. The Ward, I thought, was just, I'll forget about it. I understand why Johnny Depp decided to let Amber Heard come into his life. She was smoking hot in 2011. She's still a beautiful woman now. That's about all I can recommend.
So slasher films are kind of your major.
I like those. I like those. And then you switch over and Shutter Island, you know, when I watched it, I was like, oh, this is a terrible movie for this list, because I found Shutter Island on second viewing to be just a profoundly sad movie. Yeah. And kind of a deep introspection on grief and trauma. It really didn't feel a lot like Halloween to me. The other two on both sides, though, Smile and Shutter The Ward definitely were.
Yeah, I agree. I don't know if it fits as a horror film. There are scary components to it, but it's not really a horror film. Mark, what about you?
I chase quality. You know, I try not to be a snob when it comes to genre. I think I look at every film as an opportunity to communicate. And if you do a good job of communicating what your idea is, then it's a good movie. And if you don't do a good job, then it's not a good movie.
What's your favorite horror film?
Oh, wow.
Can I guess?
I'd be interested what your guess is, but I've seen a lot and I've got a lot of different categories.
My thought is it has to be something deeply weird and like Lovecraftian for you to like really enjoy it. It has to be like, there's something about Lovecraft based stories that creep me the fuck out. And I don't know what it is. It's like this despair, this really cynical, dark view of humanity as just basically flesh. It's something about that's so troubling to me.
Are you talking about Hellraiser?
Like a Hellraiser, like Clive Barker.
Hellraiser. I loved Hellraiser.
Yeah,
it was a lot to the Lovecraft mythos for sure.
So what do you think? If I had to pin you down on one, you can change your mind later. It's fine.
It's funny. I'm experiencing right now something that the post Gen Xers will not have as much experience with, which is like video store anxiety, which is like I'm confronted with all of these volumes that I could choose from. And I'm like, what was the one that I always say I want to, you know, whatever. But lacking another thing, it's funny because I'm not the world's biggest Zack Snyder fan, but I would say that the horror movie that I have the most to say about is probably the Zack Snyder version of Dawn of the Dead, which is a movie that I actually think it's fairly like illustrative of my perspectives on movies in general, because I went into it thinking, oh, this is gonna suck, you know, because the original movie was like such a like, you know, there was so much subtext to it, you know, it was so state of the art for the time, you know, there was so much to it. And then I'm like, oh, this is just gonna be like a hackish modern remake. And in the first 10 minutes I was like, this is freaking fantastic.
It was pretty good. It's his best movie.
Yeah, completely different kind of thing than the original. Yeah. But it's just like quality is quality. Let's watch it.
I am looking that up as soon as we hang up tonight. I had no idea that Zack Snyder made a Dawn of the Dead remake.
It was good.
It was good.
Is there a lot of slow-mo and glistening sweat?
No bullshit. No weird racist. Oh,
there's very little slow-mo to it whatsoever. It's quite a fast-paced movie.
It's very quick. It just starts and it goes. It's great. That is a good movie. Tyler, let me ask you. Yep. Is it possible to make a film about real psychological conditions? Because all these movies are about trauma, really. At the root of them, they're all about trauma. Is it possible to make a film about real psychological issues that is not in some way exploitative or promoting misconceptions about mental health? Has that happened? I think Smile kind of seems to do it for you, but is that the rare film?
It's so hard because the tropes that mental illness offer to writers are so alluring, like the dissociative identity at the end of it, or the, you know, whatever the trope is, it's just so easy to do. You know, my specialty in research is in suicidology, and the number of times that suicide is like the punchline of a movie, or like the climax of a movie, or the ending of a movie,
or the starting of a movie,
or a starting of a movie
with someone, you know, suicide.
And so, you know, I think it can be done really, it can be done well. I'm struggling right now to think of movies where I was like really, really happy with it. But I always think when it's kind of like anything that can be tokenized, when you don't make the story about the presence of the thing, but you make the person who has the thing be in the story, I think that's what you want. You don't want the like the twist to be, oh my God, they had schizophrenia. But if you had a person who has schizophrenia be a character in a movie and they go through stuff, that's a better representation of it, because of course the challenge is turning people into these caricatures. So I think it takes such an advanced level of writing, and I don't, like, I like horror movies. I've grown up with horror movies. I'm not as much a fan, you found out from my brother, as I used to be. Mm-hmm. They're not like the writing is it kind of goes, you're going for feelings more than really great writing and plots is the best way I could describe it. So
yeah, no, I understand. Yeah. I actually used to be a lot more into horror films too, until I started to really get sort of just depressed by the horror of reality. Now I'm all about comedies whenever possible.
I do this weird thing now where I, my brother, who's still really into horror movies, we'll go see one, and I like Smile was one, but the one that I remember the most was Paranormal Activity, which mm-hmm. I found really scary, and I thought the first one was really good, but the whole time I would turn to my brother and I'm like, why am I doing this to myself? Why am I doing this? This is too stressful.
Right.
So I just didn't enjoy it.
I thought Paranormal Activity was one of the scariest movies that I have seen since The Exorcist, just because it was completely new. And I don't get scared much. I don't freak out, but I thought Paranormal Activity was great.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that one too. That was good. I mean, I have to say, I don't watch too many horror films anymore. And in fact, psychological horror films are my least favorite form of horror film. And you know how you can tell is I didn't watch any of these movies that we're doing tonight until this episode. And I mainlined them in one day, which probably did damage to my brain. It was too much for me, but I watched three movies in one day. So let's get to them. Let's cover them. Let me start by asking you guys objectively, and I'm pretty sure we're going to agree, which of these movies was the best? Which of these movies was the worst?
Oh, as a film, I mean, Shutter Island was ridiculous. I mean, just the cast alone. Like, I don't recall from the first watch through, like, I mean, the cast was amazing, like top to bottom. Just these character actors that you've seen in a million things that I cannot name. But they were, that was actually cinema. Like, it was real cinema. I don't consider it a horror movie. For sure. I'd say Smile second and The War at a Distance third.
Yeah, I think we all agree with that, right? Let's start with Smile. So, Mark, you're really good at this. I don't know if you guys know this, but a lot of times I just don't get to watch movies, or like, and I don't actually ever get around to it. So I'll just like call Mark and be like, Mark, can you just tell me about this movie? You just tell me everything that happens in the movie. And he'll do it for me. And it works really great. So, Mark, would you be willing to do that right now for Smile, just to give people an outline? And again, spoilers are going to come here, folks. So
actually did my best when I was coming up with synopses of all three of these movies to be as spoiler-free as possible. If you would like to bring out more details beyond what I came up with, then feel free to ask. But
fair.
Smile is that... Smile follows a psych ward therapist named Rose Cotton. And at the beginning of the film, Rose meets with a freshly admitted patient. The patient is in a state of agitation, claiming that she's being followed by an evil presence that appears in the form of a normal person, sometimes somebody that she knows. And the presence makes itself known with an unnatural and unnerving smile. The patient flies into a full-blown panic when she looks over Rose's shoulder and sees the phantom in the room, though at this point it's invisible to Rose. After turning away to call security to help, Rose turns back to see the patient staring at her with an unnerving smile, and then the patient slits her own throat with a piece of broken glass. Over the next several days, Rose herself begins to see more and more frequently this same phantom appear just as the patient described it. Sometimes in the form of somebody that she recognized, always with an unnerving smile. She also learns that she and the patient are the two most recent in a series of incidents in which a subject begins to be haunted by the phantom after having witnessed the violent, smiling death of the previous subject.
It was very good. This is why you should read his blog, people. So a couple of questions right off the bat I had. So this Dr. Cotter, this character is
Cotton.
I think it's Cotter.
I think it's Cotter. Yeah.
I watched it with subtitles. That's why. Regardless, this quote unquote doctor, this is one of those issues I have. Is she a medical doctor? Because at one point the people refer to her as a doctor, but then And they're saying she works 80-hour work weeks, which, by the way, we haven't done since residency, 80-hour work weeks.
You're right. Dang it.
It's all right. It was a great synopsis otherwise. And we'll fix that in post if I get my editor back. So
I worked 80 hours last week, just FYI.
Yeah, but are you going to be off for like a week?
No, 5 days. I had to pick up 70 hours this month. We're two doctors short. Don't talk to me about it.
Sorry, buddy. Okay, it's hard work. No, so it again, it's like, what is she? Is she a doctor? And then that's unclear because these movies never have a great answer for that. They want the person to be a doctor, but they want the person to be doing stuff that doctors don't really do, which is like, you know, more the therapy stuff. And then like you nailed it. The first real problem I had with it is she's in a room with this patient. This patient's having a mental breakdown. She goes to the phone to like call. And while she's on the phone, she has her back completely turned to the patient, not seeing what's going on in like true, like WWF, like wrestling referee, like letting some chaos happen in the background that she doesn't catch. That's the first thing that kind of bothered me. And then she turns her back and she sees this horrific smile. But I have to say, I know I'm supposed to be scared, but the smile was so silly. And it could be scary. I could see it being scary, but it also just reminded me of something that like one of my friends would do to creep me out. And it kind of made me happy in a way. It kind of made me like smile because I'm like, oh, I could totally see one of my friends in a dark alley doing that to me just to fuck with me. You know what I mean? So the smile thing, I did it. I don't know. It didn't terrify me the way I think it was supposed to. And that sort of like Pennywise the clown, sort of the happy thing turns into an evil thing sort of way. What did you guys think?
Oh, I thought it was great. I thought that was like that. That was always the best. That was what that entire movie did best, I think, was without, you'll notice if you go through it, there's actually, it's hard for me to think of any CGI that was injected into it. It was all just performance.
Well, there was one scene where the sister walks out to the car and her head falls off.
That might not have been CGI.
It might have been practical.
Maybe.
So famously, I think the team that made it, they really did it as an homage to the movies of the 80s and 90s. So they did it all in practical effects. So everything done was a practical effect. Yeah.
Yeah, and I actually think that this is something that I really, you know, just stepping back for a second, that I really appreciate about modern horror. And now I'm back to the whole video anxiety thing where I'm now like thinking of a flood of contemporary movies that I think do this well, you know, like It Follows or The Babadook or whatever, we're making horror movies now were the ones that were watching the crappy horror movies back, you know, early 80s and stuff like that. And then they grew up and they went to film school and they learned good craft and they learned how to write. And so they're good at you know, I don't know, like if you haven't seen Smile, this is a scene that I found immediately unnerving, and they would come back to this particular touch point. It's just interesting to me how a lot of really successful horror movies these days can take things that seem really innocuous, like somebody smiling, or in the case of It Follows, somebody walking across a room, and make those things seem really chill.
I'm glad you bring up It Follows, because to me, It Follows, and if you haven't heard of or seen this movie, Steven, have you heard of this movie, It Follows?
Heard of it, but I haven't seen it.
Dude, I think it is the best example of these types of movies. These ring-like curse goes from one person to the next person. But the allegory there is less like mental health and more like, I don't know, STD. Yeah, it's like more like an STD. Like this curse gets passed to people through sex, and basically this creature follows you and just is walking towards you at all times,
just in a straight line.
It's just a straight line, and you can do whatever you want to get around, but it'll get to you. And I thought that movie did that so well. This movie owes a lot to it, particularly what I thought was the creepiest part of it, which is where the mom creature, that's the scary part, when she like comes through the doorways. They did that like twice, because that's the best scene in It Follows.
Just an actor, not computer graphics. It's just a real old weird looking dude that they cast.
Oh, no kidding. Oh, that's great. That person was freaky as shit. That part really, that was the part that got me. And that came from It Follows, I think.
Here's the thing about like a successful horror movie versus an unsuccessful horror movie is that when you're trying to make a horror movie, what you're trying to do is communicate an emotion the same way that you're trying to do it when you're making like a love story or a comedy. It's just in this case, you're trying to express fear. And so the success of a movie like Smile is going to be like, if you see this thing that you know is like a mortal threat and it's smiling at you, can you use a smile by itself as a means of conveying a sense of malice? And yeah, that is what happens in this flick.
Yeah. Yeah.
Whenever you see the character pop up, and it pops up repeatedly throughout the flick, you know, and all the time, what you're experiencing is just this thing that has an innate lack of respect for your life and, you know, and any
mental well-being
about you. Yeah. And it's just sitting there with, it's malice. Malice is communicated in the smile very effectively.
I wanted to point out the thing that I really liked about Smile that I think I mentioned this even in our last Halloween, but I think I just brought up Smile spontaneously, but the way in which her partner tries to support her but just really wants her to get her own psychiatric help was just, it was so realistic. I'm so tired of the you know, the partner or the friend who's like, oh my God, you're haunted by a ghost. Let's go get the Ghostbusters and we'll go bust that ghost. Her partner was like a human being with no changed sensorium, who's basically saying, you really need to get help. I really need to get you help. And didn't actually fall for the delusion at all. Just really worried for their partner. I thought that part was really cool because it was so frustrating from the protagonist's point of view. But I empathize so much from the partner's point of view, who is like, I really need you to get help. This is not good. So I really like that.
I like that. That was Jesse Usher from The Boys, by the way. Shout out to The Boys. But like, he also is interesting because he's also like, hey, look, I think it's fair for me to ask questions about what's going on here because we're about to get married and you want me to have kids. And I think this is a genetic thing that is happening here because your mom was crazy and now you seem to be going crazy. And so that was interesting how they made that was realistic. I think that is kind of how that would actually go. That is probably how that conversation would go in most of the situations. Stephen, what do you think? I thought it was a good movie, but there's a lot of little things that took me out of it. I'll tell you what those little things were, but I want to hear what you think first.
I mean, I enjoyed the movie overall as it is. You know, I spend 90% of my movie time now because I'm ADD, distracted by a phone. But I watched it about 6 months ago just for the first time. And I caught the last 20 minutes because I didn't want to sound stupid when I talked about it today, because I know that's where it all really came down. But I enjoyed it. I mean, for the smile, for what it was, it didn't really take me out of it. Like, I enjoyed it as a trope, because they had a great social media push prior to the movie with the smile. I don't know if you guys saw like the baseball games where people were at, where people were just standing there the whole game, smiling with a ridiculous grimace on their face. I thought it was freaky. I enjoyed it. It was what it was. It reminded me of the old school stuff.
But there's little things like, you know, she goes to her ex-boyfriend who is a cop, and she's like, I need you to look up a case. And he's like, come on. She's like, please look up in your police files. And he's like, all right, what's the name? And she's like, Gabriel Munoz. And he's like, okay. No other information on Gabriel Munoz.
Yeah, great. Got it.
And he's like, oh, yeah, I found him. Here it is. And I was like, come on.
That guy murdered himself on a security camera.
I'm I know like three Gabriel Munozes myself, personally. Okay. He would have taken him a lot longer.
For a second. Believe that for a second.
The problem is,
let me just say this to the listening audience. If your name is Gabriel Munoz and you are a follower of House of Pod on Twitter, DM me.
I know zero Gabriel Munozes.
The thing is, I can move past some of those things if it's a movie that I want to enjoy. But there's a part of my brain, it must be a defense mechanism, when I'm watching a scary movie, I'm looking for things that will keep me from getting scared. Like, oh, I bet you they did this take like 400 times and it must have been such a fucking clusterfuck when they did it. Or this is what I would have said in that part to make it funny. You know, like I'm thinking of those things that are like, they're doing it for me. But I had one major problem with this movie. Okay. Because it is a good movie and I do recommend it, I think. But it did something that kind of annoys me, which is like when a horror film tries to pretend it's something much bigger than it really is. It's about deep trauma. It's about this woman's relationship to her mom and the trauma that she experienced and passing that trauma from person to person. And then like she goes through this whole experience at the end where it's like she's facing it. But then at the end, they still have to just twist the knife and give you that last twist and say, oh, no, she's still fucked. Oh, she did all the right things she's supposed to. She faced her trauma. She did all that stuff. She faced her fear. She did that hero's journey that you're kind of expecting in the movie. But then they still twist the knife and then she still ends up, again, spoiler, dying because she can't beat this thing at the end. And I'm like, you know, like, if you're trying to make this like a lesson, if you're trying to like say this is about trauma and facing your fear, then, you know, do that. Instead of trying to say, okay, here's a sequel that we're going to do for this. We're going to set this up to have an ongoing story, or this is what horror audiences expect. Horror audiences expect something bad like this to happen. You know, I like it when horror films don't play to that. That's one of the reasons I love It Follows, because it leaves the ending kind of ambiguous. Did they win? Did they not? You don't really know. It's a really weird situation. And I thought that worked better in the, than this. That was my feeling at the end of it when I walked away.
Are you guessing out of hand at the intentions of the people who made the movie that they were trying to make it about, oh, this is the thing that you could do to fix your life? Maybe they're
I think
along was just to communicate, you know what, it doesn't matter how good a person you are, a horror movie is about something really crappy happening to you.
Well, if the lesson of it then is there's nothing you can do about trauma.
Yeah, it's a horror movie.
Because that's the thing. It wasn't just a horror film. Like a horror film is like a slasher killing people. This was about something about, this is about trauma. And they say it multiple times. And all these movies we're talking about are about trauma. And they're saying if this is about trauma, then to me, they're trying to touch on something a little deeper than just your run of the mill, we're going to scare you. Or at least they're pretending that's the case. So like I find it too cynical if it comes down to it at the end where it's like, oh yeah, it's about trauma. And if something bad happened to you when you're young, you're fucked. You're never going to get over it. You're never going to get over it.
Yeah. I liked, you know, to me, it made me, it reminded me of like the Nightmare on Elm Street sort of ending where, you know, they get it. The dawn comes, everybody's smiling. And then all of a sudden the girl gets yanked through the door's window. The awful model of the girl gets yanked through the door's window. Like, or, you know, the thing comes up at the end. I mean, it had the great practical effects scene where she dies and you actually get to see how the smile creature actually kills, what it really looks like and those types of things, which I sometimes think is a horror movie mistake, revealing too much about the bad guy. But then they made it really fearsome. And now you have this knowledge that despite all of her intentions, the curse will keep going. So I just thought like this is about a you know, a curse, like a literal curse. It's not going to be defeated by someone saying, okay, I'll go to a cabin and not call anybody. It's a curse. I liked it. I thought, yeah.
All right. Well, speaking of things that keep going and you can't stop it, we're going to take a quick break, do some commercials, and then we'll be right back with more of our Halloween episode. Stay tuned.
Buy whatever you tell me to buy.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Oh, and we're back. Oh my, those were delightful ads. Certainly buy those things. All of them. So we have two more movies we're going to do. And interestingly, they're both period pieces and they're both in the, it came out in the year 2010. So even though one of these movies seems like it came out in 1963 from a high school production, they actually came out in 2010. Let's start with The Ward from master filmmaker John Carpenter, the man who brought us The Thing, which we've covered on this show on one of the Halloween episodes, which is, I think we can all agree, an amazing movie. It brought us Halloween. Even The Vampires was better than this steaming pile of turd, The Ward. Oh, yikes. It's just an awful movie. It is an awful movie. Mark, can you give us the rundown on this one as well?
The Ward is a period film taking place in the mid-1960s. A woman named Kristen is brought to a psych ward by authorities after she burns down an abandoned farmhouse in rural Oregon. She tells the admitting nurses that she can't remember anything about her past before that. On the ward are four other women of about the same age, each with a different disposition. Emily is chaotic, Iris is creative, Sarah is flirty and seductive, Zoe is childlike. We learn of two other women who formerly occupied the ward: Tammy, who was killed by an unseen assailant in the opening scenes, and Alice, who has been killed prior to the events of the story and whom the other patients believe is haunting them all and killing them off one by one.
All right, guys, what did you think?
I don't think it was a steaming pile of crap. I think that there is room in this world to, like, instead of just awarding A's and F's, I just think that this movie was kind of a C minus.
I think that's generous, but okay. What about you guys?
I mean, it was fine. I mean, you know, I'm looking at it in retrospect with knowing the twist. Should I spoil the twist now?
Yeah, go ahead.
So the twist now is Amber Heard's character, the main character of the show. Her name was
Kristen.
Kristen.
Exactly, Kristen. But nothing memorable, yes, about her. Nothing memorable.
Kristen about is actually one of the personalities of a young lady who is in the mental hospital named Alice, who is the ghost in the movie. So looking back in retrospect, honestly, once I found that it was a split personality story, a dissociative identity story, I hated it a little less. Like, the whole way through, I was just finding on ways to be snarky about it. I was like, oh, there's four girls in the whole hospital and they're all hot. Even the one that's acting like a baby is a pretty girl of the, you know, about 25. I was like, what is happening here? But looking at it backwards, I mean, I didn't hate it. Would I watch it twice? No, I wouldn't watch it twice. It had a lot of tropes. It was kitschy. It felt very formulaic to me.
Yeah. Jesus Christ, you guys are so nice. It's like, you know the people who made this? Why is everyone being so fucking, this movie
know the people who made this? The person who made this was John Carpenter.
Personally, is he going to find out? Is he going to find, there's probably a backstory to this. Like, he probably checked out and had his son direct the whole thing. Or so there's some story, I'm sure, if we found out.
It's funny, actually, because apparently John Carpenter's wife refers to this as his chick flick.
I would give it like a D. I hated it all. Like Steven said, I hated it a lot less when it became about even though I hate the dissociative identity trope, at least it made all of the things that were happening to her less about, like, you know, the evils of her treatment, and more about the fact that, you know, she's a personality within someone else, and so there's this back and forth. But it was not I didn't find the acting particularly good and compelling. Like, there was times where it was supposed to be there was supposed to be portrayals of horror that I actually laughed at it. At the beginning I was so like, oh my god, okay, it's a scary psych ward, they're using ECT to punish people, they're getting all these, mm-hmm, you know, injections just because they're making noise, you know, and all this stuff that's just like, oh shoot, another movie that just makes psych wards look like this.
No, it's always funny how they do these ward things in the past. It's always like in the 60s. Yeah, like, yeah. It seems like the wards had their heyday in the 1960s, well, you know?
And I'll be honest.
Because Reagan shut them down, right?
That's a good point.
I still meet with families to talk about starting ECT, and a lot of the a lot of the formulations that families have when they start the discussion come from movies like this, where it's about like how ECT was done in the 60s. Like the number of times that I'll be asked, like, you know, do you do it to people when they're awake? And I'm like, no, there's anesthetic. It's like a very, like, it's a boring procedure now. You know, with the One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is probably the one that people think of the most, but yeah. Movies like this, I even had a patient use Zack Snyder movie Sucker Punch, I think, was on a psych ward, and had a question based off of Sucker Punch. So you know, these movies do perpetuate myths that actually do affect patients, that actually affect patient care. I've actually had to like tamp down the no, we're not going to just inject you in the side of the neck, which is the worst place to inject someone. Don't inject people in the side of the neck.
There's a lot of that.
And bite on the stick while I shock the shit out of your brain.
Okay, I have a question though, as the non-medical person here. Is that something that's a myth perpetuated by movies, or were there different practices around ECT back in? I mean, like,
that's where it is. Were
period pieces.
That's, I think that's why they do the period piece, because it makes it, you know, yeah, I think it brings it back to a time where technology couldn't save things, and it makes it a little bit scarier. But certainly, like, the origins of ECT were, you know, like any origins of medicine, it's pretty barbaric stuff. Like, the origins of pretty much every surgical practice, every, you know, anything, they come from pretty bad places. And ECT kind of split off. There was an original ECT was unmodified, meaning no muscle relaxant, no anesthetic, and you can imagine that would be just exquisitely painful, and there were lots of broken bones and teeth and all sorts of things like that from that. Of course, as the science progressed, it became, you know, a medical procedure. So now you're given a muscle relaxant, now you're given an anesthetic, you go to sleep for it, there's very little seizure going on, and you wake up. So certainly it has that origin, but I think that the perpetuation of it is
no one's shown it, at least as far as I can tell, as it is now, is part of the problem, which is, like, as you said, a very boring procedure that is very, like, mild for, I mean, or should be, at least. You know, my major issue with the movie is that it's fucking boring. There's a shower scene with, like, five cute girls and a ghost, and it was the most boring possible scene you could have. Like, how did you fail there?
You got like one half of one side boob in one shot. I was like, if you're going to like do a dial back to the 80s, I mean, come on, the shower scenes. I was like, oh, here we go. And no, it was like made for 2011 audiences or whatever. I remember the rated PG-13 movies of my day. You didn't get side boob in a shower in a horror movie.
You got Porky.
I mean, yeah, yes. Yeah. It was like, what is happening?
Yeah, I'm moved to actually mention, this isn't a movie that we watched for this segment, but recently I went and caught a revival screening of Psycho.
Oh yeah,
the original. And one of the comments that I had on it, coming away from it, is that it's interesting watching a movie like Psycho, already knowing not just that there is one major twist, but there's actually two. One is that when you go into Psycho, you at this point probably know the major twist is that
Norman Bates
is actually his mother. But the other thing, if you don't know anything about the movie, is that you think for the first half of the movie that it's about Vivian Leigh, Janet Leigh.
You're the Hollywood guy. I don't know.
And so when you watch a movie knowing what its twists are ahead of time, you put yourself in a position in which you are now watching multiple movies at once. You're watching the movie in which you know what the twist is. And so you're saying, okay, here's a person who either has psychological difficulties, or in the movie, the case of a movie like The Ward, the character itself literally is a psychological difficulty. And so you're analyzing it from that perspective, and you're also watching it from the perspective of, I don't know anything about this, and so I'm just perceiving this as, you know, as the play goes on. But I think when we talk about when we introduce the idea of film quality, is this a good movie? Is this a bad movie? Into the conversation, we are also watching multiple movies. We're watching, you know, the movie that we're watching, where we're saying, oh, okay, this is all the, these are all of the ways in which this film is falling short from what it's trying to accomplish. It's boring. You know, they're not practicing good medical science. There isn't enough side boob in the shower, for example.
Valid.
And
side boob, no full boob.
We're saying, okay, what if we were to forgive all of these things and we were to just treat the story as the story and say, like, how, you know, what would it be like to be this person under these circumstances? And there is this thing that comes up whenever you're talking about films that are about people on psych wards, for example, where you say to yourself, what are the innate fears that would be conjured just by being in this experience? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is a really good example, because McMurphy doesn't know what's about to happen to him. He's just a dude sitting in a chair chomping down on a mouthpiece. You know, all of the fear and anguish comes later when he realizes he's in a situation that he can't get out of. But yeah, I don't know. I lost my train of thought. Somebody else who has a medical degree can go ahead. Go.
No, I listed some questions that I wanted to ask, but really I was glad Tyler was coming on, because I wanted Tyler to give us all the definitive answer as to whether dissociative identity disorder, as it is seen in the movies, is a real thing. Because I know it's not. It can't be. But what is happening in these patients' minds that are diagnosed with DID?
Yeah, so it's so first, you're going to get a lot of answers when you ask a lot of psychiatrists. And this is actually an area where you can actually get yourself into a lot of trouble from commenting on. So I'm going to say what I say, knowing that this is something that can actually upset people. But first off, the way that dissociative disorder sort of is portrayed, like people have multiple personalities. So that's not the way the brain works in terms of personality disorders, personalities. Like, personalities are not discrete things. There aren't people living inside us. But what is true is dissociation happens, where people lose touch with reality. That is a thing that happens. We see it very famously in people who have PTSD. Of course, there's other forms of trauma that can do it. And any distress really can make you lose touch with reality. There is a whole bunch of people who think that DID is caused by therapists who believe in DID. It's like what we call an iatrogenic condition. There's a bunch of people who really, really resent that, because they do suffer from the symptoms of dissociation. So the strategy I always take with dissociative identity disorder is, it's probably really real for the person that is experiencing it, but I've been therapeutically very successful when I encounter people who say they have DID or have symptoms of DID, of just empathizing with their symptoms and not caring too much about whether or not they're valid, and just helping them with what I know to be true, which is, if you have less distress in your life, you're going to have less disturbance with your alters, or you're going to have, or whatever it is. But it's a very controversial topic. I come on the side of, I did work in a hotbed of, when I did some of my training, there was a hotbed of DID, and I know very certain that there was a lot of iatrogenic DID out there, because some people would ask the question and the person would have lots of DID, and then the next person wouldn't ask the question and there was no symptoms of concern. So I think it's probably real. It's probably very rare, and it's not the way that personality generally works.
I am not a psychiatrist, so I'm willing to say that I don't believe it's a real thing, but I do think there are probably rare cases where people, actually not rare at all, just like you said, disassociating. We know, like, people have fugues all the time. That can happen. We've seen that. We've all seen some degree of that. But it seems like it all happened from back in the 80s with, like, that story of Sybil. One story captured the nation's imagination so much. If you guys are under the age of 1,000 and not as old as us, you guys don't know. There was this girl who was abused horribly. And because of that, she developed these multiple personalities. And it became like a story called Sybil. And then it became a movie with Sally Field. And that was like when it took off, and then it became a trope in so many horror films, like that did it better than this, by the way, like Identity, which,
yep,
you know, all these other movies where it's all the same person, it's one person at the end of the day you find out, or like what the movie that did it, I thought, I don't know if it is in all accurate, but did it in the most entertaining way, which was Fight Club. That did it in like the most entertaining possible way. So I mean, I we don't have to go too much more into it. I'm picking up what yeah, Dr. Black say, here is putting down on the topic, but yeah, it I have a hard time believing anything like we see in the movies, anything I think, close to it could exist.
Yeah, and the part that I've come to, which I think is really important for us to do, especially in mental health conditions, is to get a little bit less hung up on whether or not something is real, because when someone's experiencing something that's causing them distress, it's real to them. You know, like I don't get hung up on whether or not someone's psychotic delusions are real or not when they're psychotic. I know in my heart they're probably not real, but that person is already suffering them. I'm not going to spend a lot of time arguing them on whether or not the CIA is following them. I'm just going to help them, and that must be really scary. You know, I'll talk to people about how frightful they must be because the CIA is following them, and how we're going to help them, and this medication will help you worry about that less, and those types of things. So so that's where I say we probably shouldn't get too much into whether or not it's real, and more into distress is real, dissociation is real. When we help people, their symptoms get less. And I would really like it if people, didn't. I see a lot of therapists who do a lot of suggesting in their interview style. I think the best way to interview people is to ask them open-ended questions. What are your problems? What's bothering you? How does that make you feel? Versus, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have this? I actually see lots of kids, 12, 13, who endorse voices, who don't have any voices, but they've been asked by their therapist so many times, do you hear voices? That when they're in distress, they'll say, I'm hearing a voice right now that's telling me to do this bad thing. No, they just did a bad thing, but they've been asked about voices so many times that the word voice comes out of their own vocabulary. So we do have to be careful that we don't introduce things to patients. Yeah.
Man, I will tell you, as an ER doctor, I see that all the time. I see more pediatric psych cases in the last 5-6 years of my career where the kids are like, I hear voices, and they tell me all these things, and I'm like, where? And I come out of the room and I was like, where do these kids pick that up? Maybe they pick it up in therapy. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, it happens. It's just pretty rare for kids. And I'll say, like, you know what, a lot of times kids will give me voices and visions that are very much, they're clearly influenced from horror movies. Like they'll tell me, like, I'm seeing a bleeding woman in the corner of the room. But, you know, during the mental status exam, you're spending an hour with them and they're talking to you about, they're laughing, and they, at no point did they look in the corner of the room and look fearful, which is what you would do if you saw a bleeding woman in the corner of the room. So you like the social influences of these symptoms are really strong, especially in young kids. So I do worry sometimes when psychiatric content is portrayed this much in horror movies. And I have seen so many horror movie presentations given by kids where, you know, that they're trying to express their distress. They really are in distress, but they're giving you symptoms that are created from, you know, what they've seen versus what they're experiencing. Yeah.
That's actually one of the elements that I think makes Smile a sort of interesting is that, unlike the other two films, the person who is the object of the haunt is herself a psychiatric doctor. Yeah. And so there are these scenes where you have Dr. Rose Cotter, whose name I totally know, conducting sessions or being conducted by her own therapist. And there's a moment that I recall where she attempts to say, okay, this is, you know, I met with this patient earlier, and then afterwards, these are the things that I experienced. And she calls them out as being psychiatric problems. And her doctor even says, let's avoid self-diagnosis. Let's stick with, you know, just tell me what your direct experience was. And I wondered whether that was actually, you know, that just struck me as, you know, I'm not a therapist myself. I'm actually the child of a therapist. But it occurred to me in that moment, like, that would be a kind of an interesting thing to think of. What are the storytelling possibilities of a therapist analyzing another therapist?
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I loved about the movie. And I think, you know, when I'm working with patients, you know, when I'm seeing adolescents, or, you know, I work now at a university and I worked with the university age people, you know, you can get really checkboxy with your questions, but the best content, the best engagement comes when you ask people like, okay, let's just tell me how that affected you. Tell me what that was like for you. And what I really liked is the realistic way in which the world interacted with Rose and Smile. I still think that's one of the standout things about that movie.
All right, let's move on from the ward. Actually, one last thing. I'd be surprised if anyone else noticed this, but there was one scene I didn't understand. The one bright spot is the actor who plays the psychiatrist. He's the British guy from Mad Men. Jared Harris, is that his name? I think that's his name. Anyways, he's in his office. And he's like struggling over the case, and he calls somebody, and it sounds like it's an important phone call. And he's like, yes, so I need you again for a very difficult case. I need to consult you. And you think that's like something that's going to come back in the story, but it never seems to come out in any way. Did anyone else notice that? All right,
no,
I guess I'm Rose here in this situation. None of you guys noticed it, just me. Okay. Anyways, let's move on to objectively the best film of the ones that we saw, and that is Shutter Island. Mark, please give us the rundown on this one for people who may not have seen this one yet.
Shutter Island is another period film, this one taking place in the mid-1950s on an island off the coast of Massachusetts. A U.S. Marshal named Teddy Daniels and his partner Chuck arrive at Shutter Island to investigate the disappearance of a female patient. We learn that Teddy is a former soldier who was present at the liberation of Dachau concentration camp. We also learn that Teddy has come to the island with the ulterior motive of finding a patient named Andrew Latis, whom he believes is responsible for an arson that killed Teddy's wife 2 years earlier. During his investigations, Teddy suffers from migraine headaches and repeated hallucinations of his dead wife, and it becomes less clear whether Teddy is losing his grip on reality because of sinister machinations on the part of the doctors running the hospital, or whether he never had a grip on reality to begin with.
Oh, you're good, man. You're good. That's good. All right. I have to say, I never watched this movie before, but I did know the twist because Mark, I think, probably told me a long time ago.
First time I ever saw it was this.
It must have been either Wikipedia or something, because I knew the twist in this one. And I have to say, knowing it made it a lot of fun, actually, because you clearly, when they made this film, they made it in such a way that you could rewatch it and catch a lot of little interactions, little subtle things between characters. Like, so again, spoilers, the movie was 2010. I don't feel bad about this, but he is a patient. And this has all been an elaborate role play to help him break through and realize that he is actually this guy he's been looking for. He is not this made up character, Teddy Daniels. He is a man who went through an intense trauma, whose his kids died, and he killed his wife because she killed them. And he's suffering so much from that. He has this break and he doesn't want to be that person anymore, essentially. And so his doctors are trying to help him, Mark Ruffalo and Ben Kingsley. And they're doing their best to try and help him, in which is actually the best depiction of a psychiatrist in almost any horror film or movie I've ever seen. Like, they're really going way above and beyond. Like, the dedication these guys have to do this is pretty amazing, to try and create this huge elaborate role play for him to break him out of this this delusion that he has. And watching the little interactions are so much fun. Like, when you see, like, he first gets to the island, the guards are all kind of nervous when he's around. They're all like grabbing their guns a little more tightly when he's there. You notice they're all kind of like being forced to play along with this thing. And some of them are more like are into it. And some of them are like, oh, this is so fucking stupid. Why are we doing this? It's like, I thought it was really well done in that way. Now, again, I don't know. This is the same sort of thing. Like, Tyler, as a psychiatrist watching this, do you just suspend all your disbelief, or are you finding things in there that you're like, yeah, that makes sense. That sort of makes sense. An elaborate role play like this could maybe snap somebody out of their psychosis.
So it comes to one of the first things you think of when you work with someone who has like a full-blown psychosis. So, you know, I've worked with so many patients with psychosis. I'll give a fictional example, someone who's convinced that they have a tumor in their heart. And, you know, they have a delusion that tells them that there's a tumor in their heart. There's no convincing. Of course, a delusion is a firm, fixed, false idea. There's no moving it. There's no amount of evidence that would ever show it. But your initial instinct, especially when you're a medical student, a resident, or even as a psychiatrist fledging around in it, is you want to prove, you want to show the person, what if I could truly show them that there's no tumor there? Could I help them? Like if I could actually reality test it. But then it goes to the core misunderstanding, which is a delusion isn't that the person is just falsely believing something. The delusion is the illness itself, where it doesn't matter. The reality is what they think it is. It's like if I told you, everyone here, that the sky is actually red, and then I showed you spectrometry that the sky is red. I had all the scientists in the world agree with me that the science is red, that the sky is red. I gave you a book that showed that, you know, in the 1800s, people were painting the sky as red. You would still not see the sky as red. And so that inclination to do it is, it's such a core part of being a psychiatrist. What I liked about this is they did this whole role play to try and prove, hey, let's take him through this and maybe he'll get over his psychosis. But we really do sometimes really feel like we wish we could just convince the person away, but delusions don't work like that. And of course that's the sort of secondary twist of this, is it didn't help him. It didn't.
Well, okay. Well, actually let's get to that.
So disagree. Yeah. Disagree. I think they fixed him. So yeah. I watched it the second time. I didn't see it the first time, but I think that he was him at the end.
Yeah.
And he chose to be lobotomized rather than live through that trauma.
Absolutely agree. I agree. I think that's the thing I liked about this. None of these movies had a happy ending, but the first two had the dumb jump scare thing that, like, oh, you think they beat the thing and they faced their trauma and they dealt with it. And, oh, no, something comes out of a mirror and grabs them. Sort of bullshit, you know? So this one, it's not a happy ending, but I agree. I think at the end of this movie, he is cured, but he doesn't want to live like that. He's like, he doesn't want to live with the memories of his three kids dying because he wasn't an attentive father, and the memory of killing his wife, who he really loved, because she murdered them. Like, that just was too much for him. And Mark, don't you agree? Don't you think that's what happens at the end of this movie?
Yeah, I think there's a depressing dip when he's having it's a great last scene, you know, like he's sitting with Mark Ruffalo, who's Ruffalo.
I like the way you say it, but it's Ruffalo.
He sits down trying to, you might have to edit some of this because I have had three glasses of wine and I'm through my memories of the flick. But no, he sits down attempting to, you know, like it's actually the kind of embodiment of the open-ended question that Tyler was talking about earlier, where he just says, how you doing? Giving him the opportunity to just describe his experience in that moment. And the moment he refers to him as Chuck, you're like, oh no, he's back in his delusion.
Yeah.
And it happens, you know, it's just an instant, you know, and everything is communicated wordlessly. Chuck turns over to, you know, the other doctors and gives them the head shake. Like, no, this, it didn't work. It didn't take. But then there's this moment right afterwards where, you know, he says the thing about
this place makes you wonder, is it better to die a good man or to live as a monster? And then Mark Ruffalo notices that and he's like, whoa, Teddy? And he's like, he's not, he can see that he knows. Mark Ruffalo can kind of tell there, at least he's wondering. And then he walks off like to go get lobotomized.
Interesting basically. That he calls him Teddy, by the way, which isn't his name.
Right. Yeah. But he said it with a sort of like, Teddy is, are you still Teddy? Yeah. But yeah, I agree. I loved that ending, even though it was a bummer. It was different to me. I'm just so tired of the dumb jump scare twist after twist at the end, where you just know. When I watch a horror film trailer now, I know exactly what's going to fucking happen. When I watched the horror film trailer for Smile, I didn't know the ins and outs of it, but I knew basically she'd go through all this stuff. The only thing that surprised me in either of these movies, only two things surprised me in the two prior movies beforehand. One, that the orderly in ward actually wasn't a creep and was a nice guy. In fact, he was like, you know, because like, you know, like one of the girls comes up to him and is like flirting with him. He's like, I'm not going to date you. I'm never going to date you. As opposed to the creepy orderly who's like sexually abusing them. And at the end, he's like, hey, I made this for you. I hope you're feeling better. I was like, oh, that's cool. That's a different orderly. And then in Smile, the only twist was that I thought for sure the cop boyfriend would die like in the last scene, but that's kind all it is just kind of extended because you know he's going to eventually die anyways.
He died 3 days from then. Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, there's going to be a Smile too.
There you go.
What it's going to be about? It could be about this. Well, dude.
Smile made almost as much as Shutter Island did, so you know, like it's like whoa. Yeah.
Did it really? Because Shutter Island was one of Scorsese's biggest box office draws. Ever. I think the biggest.
I think Shutter Island did almost 300 million, and I think Smile did 220 or something like that. So, Smile did that on I think a 12 million dollar budget. They got to 200 and something. So,
well, with the cast of Shutter Island, I guarantee you the budget was higher for Shutter Island.
Shutter Island was great. Actually, I went down a rabbit hole on something. Do you guys remember the scene? He's having like all these flashbacks to when he liberates him and he's in the army and his squad liberates Dachau, and then they line up the German soldiers after they see the horror that they've done, all these dead bodies, and then they mow them down. So I looked it up. It's very controversial. There's a lot of different like people have written about this, but that probably to some degree happened. Like the question is how many? Was it like 30 to 50? Was it less? But there was some degree of the battalion that went in there is I looked it up, the 157th Infantry Regiment. They did go in, they saw like 2,000 plus corpses, and they were just like, fuck these guys. And they mowed some of them down. So there is some truth to that, which was pretty wild. Although there was one thing I noticed, you know, it was snowing, right? At the time, like the whole scene is set in snow and all the bodies are in snow. It happened in April, just so you know. I'm just saying, probably wasn't snowing in real life, but whatever. I'm not going to nitpick that.
Magic of film.
The film magic. I get it. Anyways, I thought it was great. I liked all the characters coming in. I like how they tried to tie in everything at the end. I think they did a pretty good job, but it is one of these movies where it's like you walk away and you're like, God, that's so interesting how it all tied together. But you're like, but why? Would that have worked? Would this role play have worked in any way? I can't see a way in which the role play would have worked. And like, it seems like a very smart way to tie it all together and to make it make sense. But like, as I thought about later, I was like, that doesn't make any fucking sense. There's just no way.
I don't know a hell of a lot about medical history, but I would say that the less that you know, the more it's an experiment.
Yeah. I mean, I did love the characters. I did love like the psychiatrist in that movie were actually like decent people trying to move science forward,
trying to do it,
I really appreciate that about the movie.
There was a cool like pharmacology point where they specifically call out the chlorpromazine that he's on, that's actually the reason that he's sort of, you know, having these symptoms that he attributes to being drugged or being poisoned, but really it's he's withdrawing from this medication that they're not giving him because they're trying a different type of therapy, because apparently the assumption is he didn't respond to chlorpromazine, and so they're resorting to this, you know, form of therapy to try and get him better because he didn't beat his problem with the medication. So that was kind of cool.
Does fucking Leonardo DiCaprio ever do comedies? Holy shit. Every movie he does is like a tortured guy who you don't know if you like or not. You know what I mean? Every character is like, is this a character I like? He's like always kind of morally questionable, but more or less trying to do the right thing at the end of the movie. Like, has he ever been in something not like, what is he really outside of Growing Pains? What has he done that's not like
trying to think of something that he was in that was going to be, that would be a comedy. I can't.
Did you guys ever watch him in The Quick and the Dead? Sam Raimi movie. He was so fucking good in that movie. His death scene in that movie was so fucking.
That was fast.
So sad. So good. So good. Anyways. Okay. All right. let's close up then. Okay, guys, this was fun. I really appreciate this. This was a good time. This is what I need in my life right now. I need more of this shit. So thank you guys for joining me for this. Let's get some plugs. Steven, where can people find you? What do you want to plug? Anything?
Dude, I have no plugs anymore. I'm at Superman Sings, all one word, at Twitter, but I just post pictures of my new puppy right now, so it doesn't matter. No. It doesn't matter. My influencer days are over, dude.
You're adorable. I love you. I'll love you no matter what, buddy. Even if you only had 3 followers.
Whatever. You'd be my Brian dude. Williams doesn't love me anymore. He's retired and he forgot about me.
You should see if you can get involved with his daughter. See what she's up to.
Oh, Alice.
I don't mean like involved.
Hey, I'm married. I just had my 26th anniversary 3 days ago.
Congratulations, bud.
26 years. I'm old as shit.
Listen, dude, I don't mean involved. She would have nothing to do with you in that way. But I mean like she has a project.
I was just thinking about that scene from The Girls where they were like,
I just want to mention right now it's 10:27 on 10:27.
Nice.
It's
what do we do with that?
1:30 in the morning.
I'm sorry if people are listening to this 2 days from now and that totally screws up the continuity for them.
They're gonna listen to this.
Listen, we're all drunk. Monday. It's fine.
Tyler, what about you?
I really don't care about Twitter anymore. So if anyone wants to follow me or not, I don't care anymore. I don't know if I'm going to ever tweet again every day I decide I log on or not. It's a rueful experience. I'm so glad though that I'm able to connect with people that I met there, but it's tough hanging on. Tyler Black 32, but you don't subscribe to X or Twitter and don't give Elon any.
Yeah, fuck you, Elon Musk, you fucking asshole.
We can agree on that. We can all agree on that. That's even worse than the Ward.
It's Mark, worse than the Ward.
Mark, what about you?
I'm not a doctor, but I play one. No, I don't.
You play music.
And you have a horror blog that we should all read.
Yeah,
I'll read it.
Yeah, there hasn't been a whole lot of contribution to it because a lot of the guys who contributed to it wound up getting married and having kids and
lame.
You know, life
weak.
But sauce.
If you are interested in reading some old reviews that I and the fellas have written, we have a horror blog on Blogspot.
Oh, does that still exist?
Yes, believe it or not. I've contributed to it as recently as a year ago. I didn't do it this year, but anyway, Blogspot, I have a blog called Horrorthon, horrorthon.blogspot.com. I write under the handle 50 Page McGee, which is also, by the way, my Twitter handle. My writing has definitely gotten better over time.
Maybe you could write a new one. Maybe you could write a new one about some of these movies that we discussed today.
Oh, I might. I might.
I want to hear about your music. Are you a practicing musician that makes his living on it?
This is absolutely true. I pay all of my bills.
I want to hear it.
You are a
you have won the game then, my friend.
Living the dream, Stephen Sample. My main music participations are I am the music director at a speakeasy style cocktail bar in the historic core of downtown Los Angeles. It's called The Varnish. Oh. And it's my favorite place on the planet. It's my musical living room. If you were in Los Angeles, come and see us. We have a music program that runs from Sunday to Wednesday, and you will never have a better cocktail.
What's the name of the place?
Amazing. What's it called?
The Varnish.
The Varnish?
The other thing.
What kind of music?
Oh, it's a jazz bar. I mean, it's in a...
Oh, I love it.
Yeah, it's in a place in a store. It's in the old Pacific Electric building, meaning that it's been there for over 100 years. The bar was an honest-to-God speakeasy back in the day, meaning there was definitely a time that you would have had to have a password to get into the back room and drink bathtub gin and do the Lindy and escape from the fuzz.
Nice, the Lindy.
Tunnels leading out of the back. And the room is absolutely haunted by sex ghosts that will make you do untoward things.
Ghostbusters.
I hate LA, but I'm coming.
Ghostbusters. Yes,
it's a great date night spot. I also am the bassist and one of the vocalists for an indie rock tribute band called the Black Crystal Wolf Kids. But we're a great band. We play all of the LA beer fests. This was the big notch on our belt. We were the band that played the red carpet event for the release of the new Guardians of the Galaxy movie.
Oh, that's cool. You know. And we can follow you at blackcrystalwolfkids.com. You have a website.
This is true. This is absolutely
following
true. If you're about to get married or, you know, and you want to have a really excellent party band play your wedding, we've got our proppers. We're great.
Mark is an excellent musician. I played his songs. His music is the only music that's not my music that has ever been played on this show.
True. I also am kind of amused by the fact that we have spent like the last 5 minutes talking about me, and I definitively do the least important job of anybody in this conversation.
No, you're the real hero here, Mark. You're the real hero.
But we would all trade places with you. That's the deal. We'd all trade places.
Nah, he works pretty hard.
I would.
I don't know.
I'm a 50-year-old ER doctor. I'd trade places tomorrow.
Gentlemen, this is a pleasure.
It would be an interesting exercise going back to the beginning of this episode and specifically knowing that Mark and Steven have gotten progressively drunker over the course of this episode.
I'm drunk.
Analyzing our communication choices from beginning to end.
I'm really curious that.
Listen, my wife's out of town. I just opened a new bottle.
I love you, man. I miss you.
It's come like back and see me.
I miss you too. Episodes.
The one that you don't know they're drunk and the one that you do.
Yeah, exactly. Right. We're like the Shutter Island of podcasts.
It's Halloween. Okay. We're not talking about serious shit. Everybody's next week, out. We talk about Palestine and Israel.
It turns out that there are no guests. We're all just parts of Cave's dissociative identity.
Yes. I am Cave's id. I am the baby with the teddy bear.
I am the iris of the ward. I'm the one that draws all the pictures and gets killed first.
Tyler is the seductive one.
Oh, I don't think
what's
so.
What's the little girl that held the teddy bear in the ward? I'm that girl.
Oh, I got to look this. Oh, no.
No, you
I
don't.
I can't notes because I was done speaking all of the things I'd have to do.
You don't need to. Guys, thank you so much. Listeners, have a great Halloween if you haven't already. Enjoy the season. Boo! Have fun. Watch a scary movie. Let us know what you think, if you agree with all this stuff. Thank you to Nadim for help with production. If you haven't, rate and review us on iTunes. I really enjoy it. I really, really do. I get a real kick out of it. I really enjoy it when I see a review. So go ahead and do that for me. All right. Love you guys.
Yeah.
Welcome back to the House of Pod.
Thank you guys so much.
The House of Pod.
This podcast is not a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please consult a physician or other qualified healthcare provider for your specific healthcare needs or concerns. The opinions expressed on this podcast do not represent the opinions of our employees. Details in the podcast have been changed so that patient identification is not possible. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. I'm ready for the world. I'm ready for the girl. I'm ready to save. And I'm alive and I want to stay. For the first time I'm on my way. And I'm ready for the world. I'm ready to burn this fire within. Let's begin.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.